We are continuing with the World Mission Institute series, and today we have with us Reverend Rodney Reinierson, who is a 1959 graduate of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. He received his doctorate in the field of education from Wayne State University in Detroit in 1985. Pastor Reinierson was a circuit rider missionary pastor from 1959 to 1966, serving Faith Spokane, Washington, and a widely scattered Christ Lutheran parish for the deaf throughout Montana. From 1967 to 1973, he served at Alpha, Rochester, and National Institute of the Deaf in New York. In 1974, he became executive director of the Lutheran School for the Deaf in Detroit. He is married and has three sons, and we welcome to our campus Pastor Reinierson.
Thank you. Sunday's gospel had in it that unique story of a couple of guys who spoke with boldness, to quote from the sermon and from the lessons today. With boldness, James and John said, let us have anything we want. They weren't quite as narrow-minded as it first seems. They really weren't after power over their enemies in this world. They weren't after the lottery, which is what I think a lot of people pray for when they say that phrase. They really were after the closest seats when they got to heaven. I don't know whether they were nearsighted or hard of hearing or what, but they wanted the closest seats to the Lord anyway in heaven. Their request was fairly well, tightly defined, and was not allowable, as our Lord said. I'd like to let you look again at another request, one which I assume you know well, but one which you may have some presuppositions about, which I'm not sure are entirely textual. Mark 7, some people brought a man to Jesus. The man was deaf and could hardly speak. And they begged him, that is Jesus, to put his hands upon the man. It's a story you know real well. It was the gospel lesson just a few weeks back. It comes up now once every 3 years. It used to come up every year on the Sunday after Labor Day, which made for a great celebration because nobody was around. We're probably luckier having it come up once every 3 years and not hit Labor Day, in fact. Most people, when they hear the story of the deaf man, automatically assume that the people who brought the man to Jesus wanted what they got. They wanted Jesus to do something about the man's communication skills, about his deafness and his inability to speak. I would humbly submit that is not what the text says, and I don't think that's what the text wants us to believe. Number one, their request was not for healing, but only that Jesus touch the man. Now, if you were to do a word study of the word touch, there are a number of occasions where people flocked to Jesus for the specific purpose that he would touch them and make them well from their illnesses. So if you're going to say, well, okay, the word touch in this text must mean heal. On the other hand, don't forget Mark 10, where some people brought little children to Jesus that he might touch them. I'm not sure. It's my humble feeling that these men who brought this man were not bold enough at all to say what was probably hidden deep in their hearts and minds. And I really think this is true because of another verse later on where it says, and they were completely overwhelmed with surprise. Had they wanted healing, why would have they been surprised? Had that been their spoken or thought goal through this whole thing, what shook them? I really think they had a different goal in mind. They received a fantastic blessing, but they had a different goal in mind. Their goal was that Jesus might touch this person's life. In the Greek, the text says clearly they brought a man to Jesus. Oh, by the way, he was deaf. Notice the Greek puts the emphasis first on the humanity of this individual, on the commonality of this individual with you and I, and then finally says, oh, if you want a descriptor further about him, he couldn't hear. I don't know about you, but not hearing really isn't a handicap. I used to live in Detroit, as Dean Smith announced. I lived a quarter of a mile from the end of the runway at City Airport. You can guess what I'm going to say next, can't you? Every morning at 6 a.m., a Learjet leaves City Airport in Detroit, bringing ball bearings to Chrysler No. 2 in St. Louis. Every morning at 6 a.m., that jet went up, and so did I. I never once was able to sleep past 6 a.m. ever while I lived in Detroit. There were a few days when it was not going up, and then you woke up because you said, what happened to it? Did an accident occur? So you woke up because it wasn't there. Now someone says, did this happen on Sunday? And the truth is, yes, that jet went up on Sunday too. There was no day off for it. It didn't have a Sabbath day, apparently. To not have heard was a blessing to my head house father, who was stone deaf. He never once woke up at 6 a.m. when I did. He had a blessing I didn't have. I was the handicapped one, not him. I don't know about you, but about the 87th time a three-year-old asks you a question, might be nice not to hear. Just might be. You never know. The handicap of deafness is not really not being able to hear. The handicap of deafness is the effect of that cause, the result of that thing. The problem of deafness is an inability to communicate. An inability to communicate. Now remember, the word communicate comes off of the stem common and has something to do with you and I having in common ideas, thoughts, feelings, etc. The problem of deafness is an inability to communicate. We learn to communicate because we heard. From the time we were itty-bitty babies, someone was standing over us, brainwashing us, saying, Mama loves you. Mama loves you. True statement, fantastic statement. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Fantastic. But somebody kept saying that and saying that until one day we decided, enough, let's try it. And we said, Mama. And we found out that that big person bent down and hugged us all the more and loved us all the more, and we said, communication works. And probably a month or so later, we accidentally said, Dada, and we control the entire world around us. Pretty small world, but we controlled it. Communication, that is language, we learned by hearing. The average five-year-old child knows how to use appropriately and correctly over 5,000 words and can understand the meaning of an additional 15,000. Little pitchers indeed have very big ears, to quote an old maxim. The average deaf child with loving parents who have worked hard from the time they discovered the child is deaf, at age 5, the average one has 300 words. 300 as opposed to 5,000. Knows no more. 300 as opposed to 15 to 20,000. There is the handicap of deafness. A handicap that most deaf never make up. All their lives they will be short of words. A few years ago, I got a telegram from Nigeria. the director of the Lutheran Hour in Nigeria said, "Can my deaf son come to your school?" in Detroit, where I was the director. I sent a telegram back and said, "I happen to know there's a deaf school in Detroit, in Nigeria. Why would you do this thing?" He sent back a second telegram that said, "You don't know something. You don't know that the school in Nigeria is owned and operated by Muslims. If my son goes to that school, he must, of necessity, learn the Islam religion. I don't like that choice." But what you also don't know is that in the country of Nigeria, if there is a Muslim in the room, it is illegal to talk about Jesus Christ. Now, this law isn't always enforced, but it is illegal to talk about Jesus Christ. The net effect would be if that son went away to school and came home, the father who was in charge of the Lutheran Hour could no longer talk about Jesus Christ. He had a fairly large choice. One, love Jesus, serve him. Two, have an ignorant son. Have an ignorant son. Because if he sent him to school, he was in trouble over against his faith. The father made the choice that we would appraise and applaud. The father said, "I will not send my son to school." At age 12, Dale came to us in Detroit. He stood this tall, chocolate brown, fantastic young man, didn't know his name. Didn't know he had a name. Had no words, absolutely no words. Didn't know what graphic symbols meant. Totally ignorant of words. Not a lot of other things. Real sharp young man. If you want an ending to the story, by the time he was 18, he had graduated from high school in the United States. Real sharp young man. Just did not have a way to communicate. That's the problem of deafness. How to communicate? Deaf people, born in hearing families, have as their primary language not English or American, whatever it is we speak. They have as their primary or first language visual movement. That visual movement may be codified into something that's called the language of signs. But basically, they have visual movement. They will learn English as a second language. And most deaf, with few exceptions, will end up knowing English just about as well as most of us of the younger generation know German. Who'd like to volunteer to preach German next Sunday? Okay. Maybe my point's made. Interpreting, which happened today in chapel, kind of neatly. Interpreting, which is something we are promoting more and more throughout the church. We have at this point over 200 congregations of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod who every Sunday, we think, maybe once in a while they don't, but every Sunday have interpreted worship for the deaf. Interpreting means that the individual in the room is minimally a sentence behind. Did that occasionally happen to you today? Minimally a sentence behind, and perhaps maximally a lot more than that. Neat sermon today. I enjoyed it and thank God for it. The pace at which it moved, though, left Peter a little bit breathless. Is that a fair statement also? Okay. In addition to which, one of the things that happened in the sermon this morning is something that you expect to happen in theology. A lot of passive verbs. You expect that to happen in theology. I have been saved by Jesus Christ. Good sentence. But let me tell you something. 99% of all the deaf haven't the foggiest idea what a passive verb is. And there is no good way to sign a passive verb. As an interpreter, if you don't know your speaker, you can be led down a primrose path by us Germans, which gets you going through the subject and a whole series of clauses, and you'll be, you know, a half hour into this paragraph, and finally comes the verb at the end, like any good German verb, and it dawns on you just a kind of second before you hit that verb, we're in a trap. It's going to be a passive verb. And there's no way out of this. short of admitting it and going back and starting over again and making it an active verb. Jesus saved me, by the way, is just as nice a sentence, but it's an active sentence. That's the problem of interpreting. Interpreting will not solve the problem of commonness between deaf and hearing in most cases because of the fact that to get it common, we've got to have a good idea of what that sentence was and where it was going so we can sign it. Sign language is not a visual representation of English, contrary to the belief of a lot of people. It also, by the way, is not a universal language. It is not possible to go any place in the world and sign and everybody understands the same. This is not true also. It is neither a representation of English, nor is it a universal language. Of the some 2,800 signs that I know and use regularly, a very limited vocabulary, as you could well guess, since theologians know, what, 65, 70,000 words plus, not counting the Greek and Hebrew ones. Of the some 2,800 words that I know, about 300 or 400 are in fact common throughout the world. I have met a deaf person at a Buddhist temple in Thailand. I have met a deaf person in lots and lots of places all over the world, and I have been able to communicate somewhat with them. But we'll never get too deep into theology, and we'll never get too deep into philosophy, because 400 words doesn't get you very far very fast. I don't have time right now to tell you the story, but I was one time on the opposite side of interpreting. I lost my passport in France, stolen. And the police came, eight of them, in a little room about the size of the sacristy over there in the chapel. Eight of them and me, they're all talking fluent French. I don't understand French at all. Boy, did I wish I did. It's a time not to get too paranoid, although they kept pointing at me. You know, you don't want to get too paranoid. And they kept saying passport, which is a French word, by the way, not an English word at all, so at least I knew what subject they were on. Never in my life did I so much want an interpreter, and then they got one. They brought a policeman around who could interpret. This guy, by the way, knew a total of 25 English verbs. That was his total repertoire. We tried them all. Most of them didn't fit the situation, so we didn't get very far very fast. It was a fun day, I'll tell you that. Interpreting doesn't get you common as fast as you'd like to, because sign language is not only how you use your hands, but where they are in relation to your body and how your body moves and what your face was saying. In fact, your face totally changes the actions, often from a statement to a question. If you want a question, it's much more done with your face than it is with your hands. So sign language is its own language. It has a relatively complex grammatical structure. And it is not a representation of English. Anytime, as Peter did today, we use it in an English setting, we are taking it out of its natural setting and shoving it into an entirely different one, which leads you to some cultural problems. Sat yesterday with a guy who had been a missionary in England. And we said, what kind of cultural problems did you have as a missionary in England? And he said, well, the first problem we had was remembering that we were in a different culture. The language was approximately the same. And so we didn't have that tear that our missionary friends in Africa and Asia have, where every minute they're reminded they're in a different culture. In England, they have a kind of common language with us. And he said, that was the first problem we had, was remembering that the way they use words and the way we use words aren't alike at all. And we said, well, what was the biggest problem you had? And he said, the word many. And we sat there for a while and said, Minnie, what means that? And he said, well, if you've ever noticed in England, the chairs are only this wide. The rooms are only about 6 feet wide. Everything's small over there. The people are small. The everything you sit on is small. And in fact, they think that way. Their thought pattern is limited to a country of relatively small size. A Texan in England is about as far apart as you can get from a point of view, you know, this expansiveness and hyperbole of the Texans. Put that in England and you got something different going. As a pastor to the deaf, and that has been and was my title throughout all of my ministry, I never once had the privilege to be a pastor in a hearing church. The biggest problem that I had was to remember that I was living in two cultures. I was living in the culture of the hearing people, and I was living in the culture of the deaf people. And that brings its own kinds of peculiar challenges and problems. If I don't live in the culture of the deaf, I am very ineffective as a pastor. And if I don't remember that a majority of the people around me are hearing, I then get myself into difficulty with the resident culture. Let me tell you, folks, if you want to know what lonely is a deaf person sitting at the supper family table. That's lonely. Now you see, God in His wisdom continues to give deaf children to hearing parents. Someone said, how do we solve this problem of deafness? I know how to solve it. Just get them hearing people to stop having kids. The whole problem will go away. Deaf people in general don't have deaf kids. Deaf people in general, 93% of all the deaf have hearing kids. 93% of all the deaf come from hearing parents. The loneliest place in the world is the supper table. Because you see, here's this one deaf person, and now let's assume, and this is not really a great assumption, but let's assume this deaf person has learned lip reading. It's not a great assumption because only 63% of all the English words are lip readable in the first place. And secondly, if you grew up deaf and didn't have a feeling for the English language, you aren't able to guess as well at lip reading. The adult who goes deaf is a much better lip reader because they have this language background and can guess at it much better. But let's assume this person did luck out and that they got this gift from God of lip reading and they're pretty good at it. And now they're at the table and here's mom and dad and brother and sister. Now they got to find out where the conversation's coming from. So they scan the room. Oh yeah, this is the person that's talking. Now, in that time, though, the first three words were said. What are the first three words of almost every English sentence? The subject and the verb. By the time the deaf person figures out who's talking, he has no idea of who did it and what happened. He'll only get the ending clauses if he's lucky. And the truth of the matter is, probably what he'll get after the laughter subsides is a loving mom who will say, oh, we talked about Aunt Gert. Now, he'll never know what we talked about her. We'll never learn any of that stuff. He'll always, or she will always, be intensely and immensely lonely. This is what my deaf friends continue to tell me. They love their families, but they have nothing in common. We're back to that word communicate. The problem of deafness. We're back to that word one more time. They have nothing in common with those whom they love most. They are at home, but never, ever at home. That is, they are in the building, but they are never completely part of the group. This is the handicap of deafness, that they don't have something in common. Where did you learn about tax deductions and income taxes, and where did you pick up your attitudes about relatives and friends? Much of your learning occurred at that supper table. As you listened to all the things that were being said, you found out that it was entirely possible to criticize Aunt Gert. By the way, I don't have one, so that's why I picked that name, but if you do, I'm sorry. They learned it was possible to criticize Aunt Gert and still love her, deeply love her. They learned this was possible because you could hear this all going on. But the deaf person doesn't hear that. Let me give you a strange hearing. It was my privilege on at least 14 occasions to interpret for Dr. Oswald Hoffman. Now, I never got to see him while I was interpreting. You can guess why. I had to put my back to him so the deaf could see me. If I'd have been watching Dr. Hoffman, they'd have had a hard time either lip-reading that part of my body or seeing the signs which were down in this part of my body. It's a little hard to do. It didn't dawn on me until the 15th time when one of the deaf said, why is Dr. Hoffman so mad that I should look? And I did look. And now, if you got any memories at all of Dr. Hoffman preaching in public, you know that as Dr. Hoffman got more and more excited about Jesus Christ, his hands started to do this, and his face tightened up, and he looked angry. That wasn't how he felt. That wasn't what we heard. But that's what the deaf saw. Anger instead of intense gratitude for Christ's blessings. They are at home, but never really at home. The problem of deafness is a communication challenge. I suspect that a lot of you believe that because we live in the country which we live, there is no real reason why anyone born here does not know about Jesus Christ. Now, immigrants, that might be a different story. But anyone born here surely ought to know about Jesus Christ. After all, there's the Lutheran Hour, there's This Is the Life, there's all those television evangelists, there's hundreds and hundreds of ways, programs, printed materials, billboards that say Jesus is the answer, all this kind of stuff. I suspect that you're like an awful lot of people who just assume that there is no reason why anyone born in the United States would not know Jesus Christ. I hope you know that I'm leading you down a primrose path, because it's not a true statement at all. I had the privilege one time. Dean Smith said I used to travel a little bit. I used to travel 19 days and 5,000 miles every month going around Montana. For those of you that aren't Westerners, remember Montana's from Chicago to New York, and from Memphis all the way up to Fergus Falls or someplace up there. It's a fair piece of geography. And I used to be on the road a lot. And then one day, just to make life all the more fun, I got a kind of, it wasn't really a Macedonian call because it wasn't to Macedonia, but it was a call. And a guy came up out of Idaho and he said, "How come you can serve Western Washington and you can serve Montana and you can skip right over us and you don't tell us about Jesus Christ?" And I said, "I'm busy." And he said, "I am too. Tell us about Jesus Christ." And so I got kind of a quotes Macedonian call to Idaho, and I started serving some deaf in North Idaho. And 2 days later, to tell you how well the deaf's grapevine works, I get a call from Southern Idaho saying, "If you can tell them about Jesus, you can tell us too." So I make arrangements, and I'm going to go down to Southern Idaho. The school for the deaf in Southern Idaho is in a town called Gooding, which is 100 miles exactly from nowhere. And there's no way to get there either, by the way. The only way you can get there from where I was coming was you flew into Boise, and then you could wait around a couple of weeks for a bus to come by, or you could rent a car. So I flew into Boise, but this doesn't work because I'm supposed to go down there on Sunday morning. I'm supposed to be there on Sunday morning, and the first plane down to Boise goes out of Spokane at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so there's no way we're going to make Sunday morning on Sunday. So I flew down on Saturday to Boise and had a half day with nothing to do and decided I'd see what I could find. And I drove downtown and parked outside of the post office and said, "Let's see if I can find a deaf person." And I sat there for quite a while, probably an hour, and all of a sudden I see a guy who's using his hands in ways that look like they might be significant, and I come roaring out of the car and introduce myself to him, and lo and behold, I was right. I had found a deaf person. By that evening, I had found 38 deaf people. He passed me on. And that evening, we would have church, totally unplanned. I went and called a pastor and said, "I want your church tonight if I can have it." And he said, "Well, sure, let's do it." I didn't know the guy from Adam. It took a little explaining, by the way. It wasn't that easy. We had church that night, and we had church right thereafter. But in that afternoon late, I came to a house of a gentleman that was then 82 years old. And I sat down in a chair, and he sat down on the sofa. And right behind the sofa, kind of like where you're sitting now, right behind the sofa is Warner Salmon's Portrait of Christ. Now, Warner Salmon's Portrait of Christ doesn't do anything good for me. It never has, but it does a lot of good for other people, and that's great, and I'm happy for it. And I sat there, and we talked for a little while, and I finally pointed to it, and I said, "Who's that guy?" And the deaf man said, "That's Jesus." And I said, "Yeah, I knew that. Who's that guy? What did he do?" And the guy said, "I am the foggiest." And I said, let's try that again. Maybe my question isn't too correct. Tell me something about him. I don't know who he is. And I said, well, why do you got the picture there? And he said, well, Mama, as she was dying, made me promise I'd keep it in my living room always. I said, how long's that been? And he said, well, she died 40 years ago. I said, that's nice. You've had it here always? He said, yes, I have. I said, who's that guy? And he said, I haven't the foggiest. He didn't know. 82 years old. Didn't know. Had no idea who Jesus Christ is. Had nothing in common with me or you in terms of where his life centered. Good news to the end of that story is, by the way, 4 years later, he was confirmed as a member of Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, and today I believe he's in heaven. Communication is the problem. Communication is what bothered that whole process, going back to that story. Some people said, we know Jesus Christ. He's important in our lives. Some people brought a man to Jesus. Some people said, we don't have anything in common with this guy. The one thing that's most significant in our life, Jesus Christ, isn't significant in his life. We want something in common. They brought the man to Jesus. Fantastic evangelism text, I would suggest. I've been arguing with the guys in the evangelism department. I really think this Mark 7 belongs to them, not to us. I think it's a fantastic evangelism text. By the way, if you're going to use just that part of the text as an evangelism text, you're going to get yourself into a little trouble, because I don't know about you, but I've brought people to Jesus before and nothing happened, so I could see. Don't forget the Holy Spirit here, folks. So I could see. Nothing happened. Remember, though, in this story, they not only brought the man to Jesus, but they begged Jesus to touch him. Very different than the way we pray. We usually say, God, would you take care of this? And then we forget it. Or, if we do remember it and it happened, we may say thank you. Odds aren't too good. Or, if we do remember it and it didn't happen, well, you know, we'll bitch and complain, won't we? They begged. Hear the word, beg. That's a problem, by the way, in the deaf community. You want to sign this word in the deaf community, you want to duck quick. You want to duck quick. I'm sure some of you have seen deaf beggars. You see them regularly out at the airport. There's a ring that works out of St. Louis of deaf beggars. They go around, they give you a little card, and it says, this is the alphabet, I'm deaf, would you give me some money? Or the lady out at the airport's always got an American, small American flag that she could sew on your shoulder if you want. I got some money. She never likes me. She gets mad at me every time she sees me because I tell her where she can go. You know why the deaf beg, by the way? The average deaf beggar in a day can usually get about $1,000 out of you suckers. Why would they work? Be downright stupid to work. This is tax-free income. Now, they won't get much of it themselves because this is its own racket. It's like its own mafia. And most of the money will go to a central administration. But this is why they beg. Now, so you signing that word beg in a deaf church is like duck quick, folks. Don't beg if you belong in that culture, because the deaf hate beggars. The 99% of the deaf who don't do it hate them with a passion. My point in telling this story in the deaf church often is, remember who it is you're supposed to beg. You're not supposed to beg the suckers at the airport. You're supposed to beg Jesus. He's the guy that you're supposed to beg. You're supposed to be like the widow who kept knocking at the door all night. You're supposed to be like, you know, those who keep coming back to him. Beg Jesus in this whole process. Having in common Jesus Christ is, from my point of view, the most fantastic thing that can happen. And it's what drives me. It's what makes me able to get up and go out to work again every day. It's what says to me, go ahead and live in two cultures. Go ahead and find yourself occasionally frustrated trying to figure out how to say something in a way that they can understand it. But it is a significant and fantastic event. It occasionally really does happen. When I was the director of the Lutheran School for the Deaf in Detroit. On one occasion, Monday before Ash Wednesday, an accident occurred to one of the students. The student was 5 years old, but she stood about that tall. Just a little lovely doll. She was one of a set of three, by the way. If you're interested in genetics, this is a fun thing to study. She was an identical triplet. Work on it. She was an identical triplet. The odds are something like 1 in 80 billion that you can have an identical triplet. And these identical triplets, by the way, all three of them were deaf, born that way. So really rare. She'd been in our school from September to there. It was her first year in the school. And she had an accident. The accident occurred in the gymnasium of the school in the presence of all the other children. The accident was of such a character that it happened about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and by 6 o'clock that evening it was shown on world news. It was on Walter Cronkite's program and everybody else's program, and when you talk about it being shown on world news, within a day I found out it was also shown on television in London, England, and Paris, France. This was a whopping and horrifying accident. Some of us had no idea the extent of injuries this young lady sustained, and some of us literally spent on our knees that whole night in prayer, saying, "You gave her to us, God. She is yours. We do not deny you the right to take her home at any time you want, but we'd sure love to have her around a bit longer." Now, God in his wisdom did things that not any of the doctors even suspected. The young lady had no internal injuries, and within less than a week was back in school. So while it was a horrifying and seemingly at that moment terrifying accident, and I must tell you that I was not in the room, but I do see it happen in my mind on some occasions to this day. While it was a horrifying accident, God blessed our prayers and returned the young lady to us. We did a whole bunch of work on did she and did the rest of the students suffer psychological damage from the whole event, and didn't seem to. At any rate, the young lady comes back to school. She's 3 days after Ash Wednesday, but on Ash Wednesday in her classroom, the teacher started a religion unit which would be given. This is, remember, Lutheran School for the Deaf is a parochial school, so we have religion every day, 5 days a week. She started a religious unit that was going to be centered around the sentence, "Jesus died for me." Now, I wouldn't think I'd have to argue with you about the validity of the sentence. I think you'd say, well, that's an okay sentence. We probably should teach something like that occasionally in life. But we decided that was going to be the topic. Now, if you want to understand how hard it is to teach that thing, you got to understand that there is no one picture of Jesus Christ. See, this is how we teach the little ones. We show them a picture. But there is no one picture of Jesus Christ. There are 200, there are 2,000, there may be 2 million, I don't know. Every one of them showing him different. Some even showing him as black and red and white and all kinds of different colors. There is no one picture of Jesus Christ. How are we going to get into this young lady's mind the concept of this individual who you and I praise so highly? That's the first challenge. The second challenge is there's no letter in the alphabet that is harder to say than the S for a deaf person. It is the single hardest letter for a deaf person to figure out. S is nothing more than the sound of air escaping. If you want to try it, be my guest. It's the sound of air escaping. It does not vibrate anywhere in your body. Therefore, if you were to put your hand here and go, nothing's going to happen. It is not lip readable. You could put your hands anywhere in this whole process, and you're not going to get out of it. The deaf will almost always say, "I hit two ball." And you'll say, no, you hit two balls. And they'll say, yeah, that's what I said, I hit two balls. They cannot get in any way that edge. And we're going to teach that kid to say, Jesus, challenge. Secondly, we're going to teach that kid the word died. Now remember, cats die and guppies die, but grandma is with Jesus. She's asleep in Jesus. She's gone to heaven. We don't, with a five-year-old in our culture, usually use the word dead for human beings. That's changing, I'm glad to say. But generally, we don't use that word with little children. Dumb, I would also say that we don't. But that's the way it is. And then, challenge of all challenges, we want the young lady to understand the words for me. So that's the whole problem with our world. A lot of people know Jesus Christ. A lot of people know Jesus died. But they never yet have figured out that it was for me that he did this. This is the significance of the Christian faith, the for me-ness. Okay, so the teacher starts out, and she's teaching away on this thing. Excuse me for a second. I don't have this problem when I sign. That tongue doesn't get dry, but when I talk, this one does. She teaches this whole thing, and during Holy Week, I think it's on Tuesday of Holy Week, about 3 o'clock I swung open the door on my office. Now, that's significant because, you see, I was the director of the school, and as the director of the school, I only got to see the children twice. I got to see them once when some teacher brought them in, usually two boys, one in each arm, and said, they fought! They hit each other! Will you spank them? That was the honor that I always got. I was the guy that was insured to spank children. Talk about a world in which we live. You have to pay for insurance now so that you don't get liability claims for spanking. At any rate, that was when I generally saw the kids. That wasn't too pleasing to me as an individual. That didn't turn me on. So I had a different system. Every afternoon around 3 o'clock, if I remembered it, I threw open the door to the hallway. And all of the kids knew that down in the third drawer on this side was a jar full of candy. Now, this is technically called bribery, but there is this passage that says the children of this world are smarter than the children of light, and I just thought I was playing a children of this world game, see, at that moment. And at any rate, this young lady who was involved in this accident comes roaring down the hall, notices the door's open, sees me sitting in there, comes running into the room, puts her head on the top of my desk. This is how tall she is, remember, folks. She's 5 years old. Puts her head on the top of my desk and smiles big. Now, she communicated with me. I knew exactly what she wanted. I had no doubt in my mind that what I was supposed to do was pull open that drawer, get out a piece of candy, and give it to her, say. But you got to remember, I was the resident meanie. That's my title, and I've got to live up to this expectation and role. And so I didn't give her the candy. I just smiled back. You again completely understood what she got out of this. She had this funny look on her face like, hey, fella, don't you know how to play the game? You're supposed to have given me candy. But then she said, well, maybe this guy's playing hard to get. I'll try it again. And so she smiled again. And I said to myself, this is fun. You know, this is good. I got two smiles. No candy out yet, just two smiles. I said, I wonder if I should try for three. I was dumb. I tried for three. You know, so I smiled again. This is all the longer her attention span is, folks. Little kids don't have long attention spans, remember. So this little kid no longer cares. She starts to look around to see what she can get into. And she sees over here, it's on my right, her left, a crucifix. It's a bronze crucifix made in Italy, and you are able to take the nails out of the hand of the little brass Jesus and out of his feet and take it off. So you could have it as a cross, or you could put it back on and have it as a crucifix, either way. Three little teeny nails, they're about that long. You make them out of pounding pieces of paper clips. That's how I've made them as they got lost over the years. I take a piece of paper clip and cut it off. That's about all size it is, round. I never was able to find any of these nails in the store. This, you've got to know, is what I was thinking next. She sees it, and she discovers the nail and pulls it out. And I said to myself, there's a carpet down there. There goes the nail. You get to do it again, don't you, dummy? But she isn't paying attention to me. She looks at it for quite a while in this position, and she finally turns to me and says, Jesus? Learning has occurred. Learning has occurred. She knows that the person on the crucifix is to be called Jesus. She didn't say the name completely right, but remember, I'm not a speech teacher. I'm the meanie. I don't have to get that final S, so I said, yeah, that's Jesus. Yeah. So she puts the nail back. And then she takes the nail out. And then she puts it back. And then she looks at me and she asks the question that I guess I should have expected, but I didn't. She says, hurt? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Stick a nail in my hand. Yeah, that would hurt, sure. Yeah, it hurt. Right. Yeah, it hurt. And she tried that a couple more times. And she finally looked to me and she pantomimed out, hurts more than my accident. How about that, folks? Can you imagine anything that will occur in your life that will supersede that moment when Christ hung between heaven and earth, abandoned by all of his brothers, abandoned by all that was light, surrounded by darkness, abandoned even by his Father? You better believe it hurt more than my accident. And at that point, believe me, I would have given the whole candy jar to this young lady if I'd have had the chance, but that wasn't the chance I got. She stuck the nail back in the hand, set down the cross, went skipping out of the room with a face smiling big and said, as clear as the day is long, Jesus died for me. I submit that for a rare moment, communication had occurred, that that young lady knew the most important fact in life, the one that was going to take her through life to eternal life. Having something in common is what those men wanted. Some people brought a man to Jesus and begged that he would touch them. Jesus touches me in a lot of different ways. He did it in baptism. He's done it in the Lord's Supper today. He's done it through his word. He's done it through his people. Jesus touches the deaf in many ways. Part of our mission program is 52 separated congregations for the deaf, 200 interpreting congregations for the deaf, 800 congregations whose pastors know that they have one or more deaf members. Fantastic. We have 2 Lutheran schools in the United States. We have 2 in Brazil. We have 1 in Hong Kong and 1 right across the creek in Macau. It takes 3 hours to get there. It's a big creek. We have a group of deaf down in Ghana, West Africa. It was my privilege to go down there 2 years ago. God does fantastic things. It's hard to imagine his imagination. When I was your age, I met a young man by the name of Charles Foster who came and said, God has called me to be a deaf missionary in Africa. And I and a few other people tried to do some reality therapy on this guy because, one, he was deaf, and 2, he was black. Now, there's nothing per se wrong with that, but in 1956, 7, 8, 9, not too many deaf people got through Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, and not very many more black, unfortunately. I'm confessing sins, I think. And we had to say to this person, your odds of getting through the seminary aren't too good. In fact, we sent him to a different seminary. We made arrangements for him to go to a Christian Reform seminary and got him ordained over there, and he went to Africa. And we supported him for many years. Congregations of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod supported him in his ministry for many years. It was a kind of an unofficial mission off on the side. And then we lost track of him. And then one day, about 30 years later, lo and behold, what happens is that on a Sunday morning in a town called Kumasi in Ghana, West Africa, 32 deaf people walk in on the little hearing church. There's only 21 hearing people there. 32 deaf people walk in and say, we're here. Tell us about Jesus. After we sort this whole thing out, we find out that that man, Charles Foster, had instructed the deaf with whom he worked that on the day I die, you are to go find the nearest Lutheran church and ask them to help you. And he had, in fact, died 2 days earlier, all the way across the continent. But the deaf knew it and were there. And we had an opportunity to spend some time with them. We were blessed because Charles Foster taught them that they used American Sign Language, so all of my fears in going over there on that 24-hour plane ride didn't come true. I was able to communicate with them, and I was able to see that they had some fantastic faith. And those people still to this day, about 30 of them, meet every Wednesday night and every Friday night and every Sunday morning for 3 hours. They don't have a pastor. They don't have a missionary. All they have is God's Word. How about that? All they have is God's Word. That's the most fantastic part of the whole thing, isn't it? That's what they need. That's what we want them to have in common with us. And it's a fantastic group of people, and daily I pray for them, and I would appreciate it if you would. You and I have made it possible, through our mission gifts and our love, to bring God's Word to lots and lots of people. Time is fleeing, as always. Would you like to ask a question or two? Or three? Or six? Oh, I put you all to sleep.
What hints can you give the pastor of a hearing church when he stumbles across a deaf person, either in the community or...
Most pastors will, in fact, if they're alert at all, find that they have a deaf person within the family of their church, usually. These demographics are 3 in 1,000. For every 1,000 people that you have, 3 of them will be profoundly deaf. And if you have a congregation that has 1,000 souls, you ought to expect to have 3 deaf. And while most pastors say, no, we don't have this, it is not true that the Lord has taken deafness out of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. They are there. If you find a deaf person, by all means, go immediately to reading and writing. The deaf can read and write English. It's a second language, but they can use it, and they'll understand somewhat of it that you said. And I've long said to pastors, if you'll just put them on your mailing list, let them know that you love them. If you'll just have somebody drop by once in a while and write a few words with them and then get the Lord's Prayer printed out and point to it as you kind of say it together and they say it together, you don't have to learn how to sign. This is rank arrogance that we think that before we work with someone, we have to know their language. That's rank arrogance. It would work a heck of a lot better if we go to them and say, I don't know how to sign, but I know Jesus. How about we make a swap here? You teach me a little bit about signing, I'll teach you a little bit about Jesus. The whole thing would be in a much better setting. Really would be. So now it's real easy. Just, put them on your mailing list. Stop by and visit them once in a while. Just have somebody wave hello to them. If, in fact, now out in Montana, I trained my deaf to go into hearing churches on Sunday morning, because we didn't have church on Sunday morning. We were at Church of the Times. I trained them to go into church on Sunday morning. If that's true, the easiest way to have a deaf person in service is by what I call a pointing ministry. That is, have somebody hearing sit down next to the deaf person and point in the book where you are. They'll be able to figure it out. Now, almost everything is printed in the book, with the exception of the sermon. I guess I better not say too much now, because I might get killed. I really believe that we ought to teach all seminarians how to read Braille. That way, when you're standing up in front and reading your sermon, you could keep your head up. Give them a photocopy of the sermon. You got a copy machine in the back room. If you don't have a copy machine in the back room, get out the old red Bible, Concordia pulpit, give them a copy of that. It's real easy to bring a deaf person into a hearing church. And they'll do that for quite a while. You don't have to have an interpreter right off the bat. Once you get 2 or 3 of them, though, then you probably do, because they'll start talking during the sermon and you'll get curious and forget where it was you were reading. And you'll get yourself into trouble, so then you might want to have an interpreter, but, first one is bad. I'm going to stay around for lunch, folks. If you ever do think of a question, why, you can ask it. I'd be more than happy to try and answer it. I think the bell's about to ring, and we do have to be out of here in 10 minutes for sure. So,
we thank you for being with us today. And we pray the Lord's blessings on your work with the deaf. And as he indicated, he will be around for a few more moments, and then we'll be eating in the dining hall, so you could feel free to join him and question him and ask him some more things as they come to your mind. And thank you again.
Thank you very much.